Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion.
Hello, it's nice that you could join the program today, and I hope you get something beneficial out of it. We're looking at the text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, by Namkhap Pal. A text mainly concentrating on how to train the mind in the attitude of bodhicitta, the wish to attain enlightenment to be of greatest benefit to all beings everywhere. It is a commentary by Namkhap Pal on another text known as the Seven Points of Mind Training. Now we've gone through the preliminary practices and the first of the two ways to generate bodhicitta, the seven cause and effect method. Then over the last few programs, we've been examining the second method, exchanging self for others. Basically, this method examines the shortcomings of self-cherishing and the advantages of cherishing others. When we can clearly see these two, we will give up cherishing ourselves above all else and instead put all our concern onto the well-being of others. If you've been with us, you may remember that the seven points of mind training in covering the disadvantages of self-cherishing advises us to banish the one to blame for everything. The one to blame for everything is the self-cherishing attitude, which we will find, if we closely examine it, causes all our problems and difficulties. Then the text tells us to meditate on the great kindness of others. This is to reveal why we should hold others as most precious. We were discussing this last week when we came to the conclusion that never mind our friends, we should even appreciate our enemies, for they give us the great opportunity to practice positive qualities like patience and transform negative qualities like anger. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama says in his commentary, the main trouble point is the enemy, the one who really gets us angry and uptight, someone who is really obnoxious and makes us really work hard not to get disturbed. So we have to turn to someone who is really our enemy, somebody we hate, and try to develop the attitude of loving this person. We need to find concern and sympathy for this person who only wants to be happy, and try to develop real heartwarming love for someone whom we previously hated. If we can do that, it is something that is extremely extensive and extremely powerful. Let's continue with this theme. But before we do, let's just take a moment to consider our motivation for joining the program today. In examining motivation, we may find that we just had some time to fill in, or that we think it's just a good idea to listen to give us some local inspiration, or perhaps something else related to the general happiness of this life. Now, these are not very beneficial motivations, because even if we do get some benefit, it won't last all that long. Soon we'll be back to our usual concerns and mental habits, and not much would have changed. However, if our motivation is purely to attain liberation, it is said that the positive force of listening will last right until we are liberated. And if we have a bodhicitta motivation, the positive potential will go right with us until Buddhahood. So, what do you really want? Let's take a moment to consider our motivation. Thank you. Now, going back to those who harm us, Namkhap Pal says that if we can work on developing compassion, even for them, and instead of retaliating, we do what we can to lead them to enlightenment, our lives will never be without meaning. He writes, if we understand how to train our minds in this way, then just as we could wander across a plain of swords if we had physical courage, or journeying to the mythical jewel islands we would need no stones to throw at the vicious dogs, so a period will come when there is no time when we do not train the mind. This is the single meeting point of all the teachings. If you have that, it is like saying one doctrine for one man, and that teaching is purposeful. The best-selling author and meditation teacher Susan Piver wrote a blog in the Huffington Post in May 2011 when Osama bin Laden was killed by the Obama administration. Actually, she covered the killing in two separate occasions, and in the first, titled Should We Have Celebrated Osama bin Laden's Death, she had this to say. Osama bin Laden is dead. We killed him. It seemed there was no choice. We were clearly in an us or them situation, and if we didn't kill him, he was going to continue to do everything in his power to kill us. As Buddhists, we're supposed to abhor all killing. But what do you do when someone is trying to kill you? Obviously, great theologians have pondered this question for millennia, and I'm not going to try to pile on with my point of view, which would be totally useless. Instead, I'll pose this question. How do you kill your enemy in a way that puts a stop to violence rather than escalates it? Strangely, I keep coming back to the same rather ordinary conclusion. The answer is in our ability to face our most intense emotions. When we know how to relate to our anger, hatred, despair, and frustration fully and properly, they self-liberate. When we don't, when we can't tolerate them and therefore act them out, we create enormous sorrow and confusion. Look at your own reaction this morning. Was there even a hint of vengefulness or gladness at Osama bin Laden's death? If so, that's a real problem. Whatever suffering he may have experienced cannot reverse even one moment of the suffering he caused. If you believe his death is a form of compensation, you're deluded. There has been an outpouring of misdirected jubilation, as if a contest had been won. Nothing has been won. Unlike winning a sports event, this doesn't mean that our team has triumphed. Far from it. There's only one team, and it is us. When those of us, especially our leaders, who now foment violence, choose instead to try to create peace, then we will truly have cause for celebration. One of us is gone. One apparently horrific, terrible, vicious person amongst us is gone. I don't feel regret for him or about this. I'm regretful for the rest of us who are now left thinking that this is a cause for celebration. It's not. It's a cause for sorrow at our continued inability to realize that there's no such thing as us and them. That whatever we do to cause harm to one will harm us all. When we hate, we cause hate. When we think we have won by vanquishing our enemy, we have lost. In killing Osama bin Laden, they lose because one of their leaders is gone. But we lose too, because we have deepened the causes and conditions that lead to more hatred and its consequences. This is not over. So what do we do? I don't really know, but for me, rather than cheering on this day, I'm going to rededicate myself to the idea of brotherhood towards all, even those that want me dead. And not because I'm some kind of really good person, I'm not, but because I know it's the only way to stay alive in the only kind of world I want to inhabit. Perhaps the way to kill your enemy is a way of putting a stop to violence rather than escalating it, is to shift our view of enemy altogether. Our enemy is not one person or country or belief system. It is our unwillingness to feel the sorrow of others, who are none other than us. So take aim at this enemy completely and precisely. Feel your sadness for us and them so fully and completely that all boundaries are dissolved and we are left standing face to face, human to human, each feeling the other's rage and despair as our own. One world to care for. And that was the first blog she wrote just after the death of bin Laden. Then after receiving a wide variety of responses to her first blog, a week later she wrote about it again, this time under the title Compassion for Our Enemies, Necessity or Naivety. Remember this title because she referenced it at the end of the article. She wrote, "Last Monday, I wrote a little about my response to Osama bin Laden's killing. Upon hearing of his death, most people expressed heartfelt and understandable relief that our hunt for one who wished to destroy us was over. Others participated in celebrations that seemed tinged with what could be described kindly as poor sportsmanship. Feeling relief and even joy at not having to worry about one particular enemy makes a lot of sense, of course. But what I was upset about was our collective inability to think of others as similar to ourselves and to see our victory not as a winning touchdown, but as a regrettable necessity that while bringing us relief, causes others fear and rage. If we are to be true victors, It will be by demonstrating our humility. It will be by acting boldly and doubtlessly to neutralize enemies by peaceful means when possible, and certainly non-peaceful means when necessary as a final resort. It takes a lot of wisdom to know when to do what here. I got a lot of feedback that I was being arrogant, judgmental, delusional, or some kind of wimp. This really confused and upset me. What I was calling for, and will continue to call for, most of all from myself, is compassion. Certainly for those who lost loved ones on 9/11, and for our whole country, which has suffered deeply, but also for our enemies. This is not because I'm some super nice kind of person. I'm not. It's because only by cultivating some kind of empathy rather than hatred can we begin to create lasting change in our world. I want my children and grandchildren to live in a different kind of world, one where they are not in fear of terrorist acts. Escalating violence and retaliation as a matter of course do not lead to this world. On a scale of 1 to 10, my certainty on this score is 11. I believe that the only route is to develop compassionate relationships even with our enemies. This is a very complex thing and requires the ability to act according to long-term concerns, not short-term ones, which unfortunately lets out almost all politicians who have to be elected or re-elected. Short-term concerns, if ever there were any. Still, someone has to go first. I suggest that we be that someone. We, us, you and me. But how do you find compassion for someone who wants to kill you? Is it even a good idea? Or the stupidest thing ever? Some commentators have said things like, well, when cornered by a rabid dog, you don't want to say, please don't hurt me and hope for the best. Others said that I'm incredibly naive and probably some kind of Mac user. Really, that was one of the accusations. How did they know? Of course, we want to protect ourselves from violence and danger. I'm not counseling stupidity, or what has been called idiot compassion, which is the idea that you're always supposed to act nice and be some kind of touchy-feely loser. Compassion is synonymous with skillful action. Action that is rooted in seeing reality from the largest perspective possible. When you are able to pay attention to the reality that exists beyond your thoughts about reality, you know what the next right action is. If you need to love, you love. If you need to avoid, you avoid. If you need to cut, you cut. There is a sense of precision and elegance and kindness in all cases. You know how to end violent situations, not escalate them. To do this, it helps to put aside your assumptions, judgments, and projections, and simply look. You open, even to what and whom you dislike. This doesn't mean forgiving or liking anyone. It simply means taking them in as a flesh and blood human being, not as a cardboard cutout who has no reality beyond your judgment. You let go of concepts again and again. You give up what makes you feel safe, secure, and right in order to do this. Thus, it is an act of extreme daring. True compassion is a profound skill, one that has much more in common with fierceness than softness. Compassion arises when you allow someone else's pain into your own heart without a personal agenda. This is what so many of us are terrified of doing, and understandably so. To view our enemy as part of the human family, rather than as a scourge to be obliterated, means we have to take on their pain as our own, and most of us are already full up when it comes to pain. Nonetheless, we must do it anyway. It requires fearlessness and a sense of genuine power. It is no way some kind of lefty, do-good, politically correct, emasculating double talk. Please remember, if we open our hearts, we can change the world. The truth is that there actually is no other way. So I'm going with necessity. She answers with the word necessity the question that heads the blog, Compassion for Our Enemies, Necessity or Naivety. That, I think, pretty much explains what it means to have compassion for your enemy. It does not let the enemy destroy you, but approaches him or her with a heart of understanding and care, even if you have to take some radical action against aggressive and sometimes extremely aggressive behavior. Compassion then becomes our internal driving force, and the real cause for our suffering becomes our own aggression and fear. But even those we can approach with care and compassion. In his book, Being Peace, Thich Nhat Hanh describes it like this. If I have a feeling of anger, how would I meditate on that? How would I deal with it as a Buddhist or as an intelligent person? I would not look upon anger as something foreign to me that I have to fight, to have surgery in order to remove it. I know that anger is me and I am anger. Non-duality, not two. I have to deal with my anger with care, with love, with tenderness, with non-violence. Because anger is me, I have to tend my anger as I would tend a younger brother or sister, with love, with care. Because I myself am anger, I'm in it, I am it. In Buddhism, we do not consider anger, hatred, greed as enemies we have to fight, to destroy, to annihilate. If we annihilate anger, we annihilate ourselves. Dealing with anger in that way would be like transforming yourself into a battlefield, tearing yourself into parts, one part taking the side of Buddha and one part taking the side of Mara. If you struggle in that way, you do violence to yourself. If you cannot be compassionate to yourself, you will not be able to be compassionate to others. When we get angry, we have to produce awareness. I am angry. Anger is in me. I am anger. That is the first thing to do. In the case of a minor irritation, the recognition of the presence of the irritation, along with a smile and a few breaths, will usually be enough to transform the irritation into something more positive, like forgiveness, understanding, and love. Irritation is a destructive energy. We cannot destroy the energy. We can only convert it into a more constructive energy. Forgiveness is a constructive energy. Understanding is a constructive energy. Suppose you're in the desert and you only have one glass of muddy water. You have to transform the muddy water into clear water to drink. You cannot just throw it away. So you let it settle for a while and clear water will appear. In the same way, we have to convert anger into some kind of energy that is more constructive, because anger is you. Without anger, you have nothing left. That is the work of meditation. Now I guess that when Thich Nhat Hanh says that I am the anger arising in me, he means it in the sense that nobody else is feeling that anger, only myself. It is part of my experience and my experience only at that time. However, I am not just anger, because I can look at the anger within me with a kind of dispassionate gaze in meditation, as though it's something there. I can see it as not actually me, not actually defining me. It is this ability to be separate that allows me to be compassionate to the anger. Otherwise, if I was really only anger, how could I do that? It is my very identification with anger that causes problems, because then I tend to externalize it by acting it out, retaliating or harming others. But we have this ability to step away, observe, and not act until we have transformed negative emotions into something constructive and beneficial. And whether I totally agree that I am anger or not, I for one very much admire Thich Nhat Hanh's advice on how to do this. We do not turn ourselves into a battlefield, but more into an alchemist's workshop, perfecting our skills in turning our muddiest emotions into those that are most pure and brilliant. Being able to have compassion for our enemies must be among our most effective tools to do this. Just to bolster the point, here is another quote from His Holiness the Dalai Lama about developing compassion for our enemies. It is from his book, Compassionate Wisdom. He says, "I must emphasize again that merely thinking that compassion and reason and patience are good will not be enough to develop them. We must wait for difficulties to arise and then attempt to practice them. And who creates such opportunities? Not our friends, of course, but our enemies. They are the ones who give us the most trouble. So if we truly wish to learn, we should consider our enemies our best teachers. For a person who cherishes compassion and love, the practice of patience is essential. And for that, enemies are indispensable." So we should feel grateful to our enemies, for it is they who can best help us develop a tranquil mind. Furthermore, it is often the case in both personal and public life that with a change in circumstances, enemies become friends. Of course, it is natural and right that we all want friends. But is friendship produced through quarrels and anger, jealousy and intense competitiveness? I do not think so. The best way to make friends is to be very compassionate. Only affection brings us genuine close friends. You should take care of others, be concerned for their welfare, help them, serve them, make more friends, make more smiles. The result, when you yourself need help, you'll find plenty of helpers. If, on the other hand, you neglect the happiness of others, in the long term, you will be the loser. In today's materialistic society, if you have money and power, you may seem to have many friends. But they're not friends of yours, they are friends of your money and power. When you lose your wealth and influence, you will find it very difficult to track these people down. The trouble is that when things in the world go well for us, we become confident that we can manage by ourselves and feel we do not need friends. But as our status or health declines, we quickly realize how wrong we were. So to prepare for that time, to make genuine friends who will help us when the need arises, we ourselves must cultivate compassion. Though sometimes people laugh when I say it, I myself always want more friends. I love smiles. Because of this, I have the problem of knowing how to make more friends and how to get more smiles, in particular, genuine smiles. There are other kinds of smiles, such as sarcastic, artificial, or diplomatic smiles. Many smiles produce no feeling of satisfaction, and sometimes they can even create suspicion or fear, can't they? But a genuine smile really gives us a feeling of freshness and is, I believe, unique to human beings. If these are the smiles we want, then we ourselves must create the reasons for them to appear. So how do we make friends? Certainly not through hatred and confrontation. It is impossible to make friends by hitting people and fighting with them. A genuine friendship can emerge only through cooperation based on honesty and sincerity, and this means having an open mind and a warm heart. This, I think, is obvious from our own everyday interactions with others. And now before we sign off, here's part of an article I found on a blog from the go-to market guy, that's all one word, Craig Morantz, who you can find at gotomarketguy.com. Dan Gilbert of Harvard University has shown that we are, in fact, terrible at predicting what will lead to happiness. Our norms, for example, would suggest that a winning lottery ticket would make our happiness scores skyrocket, while paralysis would make them plummet. Research shows, however, that winning the lottery ticket, though it creates an initial rise in well-being, does not lead to lasting happiness over time, nor does becoming paraplegic lead to lasting unhappiness. A closer look at our own experiences as well as research data suggests that the secret to lasting happiness does not lie in any goods, relationships, or achievements, but rather in what we can give. Not just material gifts, but gifts of time, gifts of love, gifts of ourselves. Compassion and service don't just make us happy, but they also have a host of other associated benefits and may even contribute to a longer life. Here's how. A brain imaging study headed by neuroscientist Jordan Grafman from the National Institute of Health showed that the pleasure centers in the brain, that is the parts of our brain that are active when we experience pleasure, like dessert, money, and sex, are equally active when we observe someone giving money to charity as when we receive money ourselves. Giving to others even increases well-being above and beyond spending money on ourselves. In a revealing experiment published in Science by Harvard Business School professor Michael Norton, participants received a sum of money. Half of the participants were instructed to spend the money on themselves, and the other half were told to spend the money on others. At the end of the study, participants that had spent money on others felt significantly happier than those that had spent money on themselves. This is true even for infants. A recent study by Elizabeth Dunn and colleagues at the University of British Columbia shows that even in children as young as two, giving treats to others increases their happiness more than receiving treats themselves. One reason compassion makes us happy is by broadening our perspective beyond ourselves. We know from research on anxiety and depression that these tense and unhappy states are highly self-focused. During stress or sadness, we are usually focused on the things that are going wrong in our lives. Research shows that depression and anxiety are linked to a state of self-focus, a preoccupation with me, myself, and I. When you do something for someone else, however, that state of self-focus immediately dissolves. Now think of a time you were feeling blue, and suddenly a close friend or relative called you for urgent help with a problem. All of a sudden, your attention was on helping them. Rather than feeling blue, you began to feel energized, and before you knew it, you may even have felt better and had gained some perspective on your own situation as well. Just like we want time and money, above all, most of us want to be loved. We seek love at work in the form of recognition, in our families in the form of respect and kindness, in our romantic relationships in the form of intimacy and social support. Ideally, we want to have good relationships and we want people to like us. In seeking this love, we can go to all sorts of lengths, including focusing on our appearance. Think anti-wrinkle chemical peels or muscle-inflating protein powders, and putting on a show or facade to impress others and to conceal our weakness and vulnerability. As I described in my last post on vulnerability and reading bodies and minds, these efforts often fail and even have the opposite effect we intended. A study examining the trait most highly valued in potential romantic partners suggests a different story. Both men and women rate kindness as one of their most desired traits. In addition to happiness and love, we all want more time and money. However, intriguing new studies by Zoe Chance of Harvard Business School shows that when we do compassion, our sense of time expands, and when we give money away, our sense of abundance and wealth also increases. And with that, our time is now up and we must say farewell. Thanks for joining the program today, and I hope it has been beneficial. Please dedicate the positive potential from our time together to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I hope you'll tune in again next week. Until then, thanks and goodbye.
never